To this single point. It is a powerful, profound conclusion to the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23 says, "Let us hold unswervingly, let us hold without wavering to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful." He will talk in that text about how it's not easy to hold on unswerving and unwaveringly to this. He will talk about that. Well, just take a look at it. Chapter 10, verse 32. Remember those earlier days after you'd received the light, when you stood your ground in great contest in the face of suffering? Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution, and other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison. You joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. He just describes it's not easy. It's not going to be easy, but hold unwaveringly to it. In verse 39 in particular, he says, "But we're not those who shrink back. We're not those who give up. We're not those who quit. We're not those who surrender. We're not those who stop. We finish." Now, where he goes logically next is he said, "I want you to know others have been faithful. Others have run their course." And so he moves into chapter 11, and he says, these men and women, they ran their race faithfully. And he goes through this list. And then he says, it's now your turn. It's now your turn. He uses the metaphor and an image of a race. That's going to be picked up in chapter 12. But they've run the race, and now it's your turn. Now you run it faithfully. Chapter 12, the text we're actually going to be in today, says there's going to be hardship. How are you going to approach this race that you run? Actually, you're writing your name in this Hebrews 11, even as you live now. Your life's being recorded as someone who faithfully ran it or someone who didn't. In chapter 12, it goes like this. Let's begin with the first verse. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men so that you'll not grow weary and you won't lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted the point of shedding your blood, and you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you. Because the Lord disciplines those whom he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons, for what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you're illegitimate children, and you're not true sons. Moreover, we've had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the moment, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Make level paths for your feet, so the lame may not be disabled, but rather be healed." There are two word pictures in here that he will build around. Both of them are very, very significant issues. One is a race issue. Let me just kind of help you draw part of the coloring in on this word. He uses the idea of a race, and he starts off with an amphitheater picture. You're running a race, and you're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. And in your mind, you probably need to picture a pretty large, massive amphitheater just filled with people. Now, it's pretty significant. He's just come from Hebrews 11, and this great cloud of witnesses that we have around us are not just bystanders or spectators. They are people who themselves have already run the race. They're ones who've already finished. And it has to do with, there's that man up there who stood unwavering, and he never gave in. And it was hard and difficult, and he lost everything he supported his family by, but he held on to Jesus, and he sits up there in row 7, seat number 3. And once you look over here, you have James who was beheaded, and over here you have Stephen who was stoned, and over here you have this woman that no one will ever know her name, but Jesus applauded when she walked in the door. And he describes around you this massive group, this cloud of witnesses who have been faithful in their run. And then he moves in and says, now you run your race. The word race in the Greek language is about right. I mean, they had it. The word race just doesn't. It's the word agony. That is the Greek word for race. It's the word agony. They ran their agony. They ran what was difficult and hard, but that's the word that they use in the text. There is something understood in this text, which is that running the Christian life is not going to be easy. He will say in the text, I want you to lay aside every encumbrance. Hate to tell you, but I know what that word means. I don't like it. It's the word for fat. It's not always fat. It uses other words. It could be other things as well, but it is normally the word for fat. When they talk about a certain guy getting on a horse, but the horse looked far too small for he was far too encumbered. I know what he's talking about. He's saying, don't show up at the starting line with a, you know, strawberry-filled donut in this hand, and you got your sack lunch in this hand, and you're munching as you run, and you look around, and you kind of got the sumo wrestler look as you go plodding down the road running your race. Stop being fat in this world. Stop being fat in this world. That's what he's talking about. There's no doubt about that. And then he moves to the idea, I want you to be a lean, mean running machine. I mean, that's really what he's about. I want you a lean, mean running machine. You have a singular vision for life. You're a Christian. You're a Christian. And so you lay aside the fatness and you lay aside the sin that so easily entangles. Man, it is hard to run to Jesus while you got your arm around a second love. And then he moves into this idea of the finish line. Set your eyes on Jesus. Don't set your eyes on the difficulty of the moment. You set your eyes on Jesus. And then it moves into the idea of don't grow weary and give up. Then it moves into the idea of discipline or training. And we need to talk about that. And then lastly, it comes down to verse 12 and uses a race image again. It's a runner's metaphor. It's a runner's picture. I'd love to tell you what a runner's picture looks like, but as an encumbered man, I don't think I can do that very well. Dave Smith, I need you, brother. This is your point in time. I want you to look at what a runner looks like, okay? This is what a runner looks like. Well, right, yeah. Dave Smith, his wife Nancy, I think Kate and Josh and Amy, isn't that right? So you may see them around here at College Heights. I got acquainted with Dave here at church. He was attending, but I kind of really, as far as the first time I was with Dave by himself, was out on the track. I was the encumbered guy, just slowly, much like a Sherman tank, would just nimble on its feet, you know, go around the cross-country track. And here's Dave. Dave was preparing to run his marathon last fall. And so Dave ran a marathon. He'd run a lot when he was younger and had gone back to running. I'm going to give you this mic, and I want you to basically explain to these people why a rational man would pick up and start running marathons again.
Well, that's a great question. I have run for a number of years, and I ran marathons pretty consistently in college. And really, one of the reasons I decided to run a marathon again was sometimes like in life, in your running life, you need something to shake you up a little bit. And I had been invited to join a couple coworkers in running. And I knew if I ran a marathon that I would push myself to levels that I had not pushed in a number of years. I knew that I would run greater distances. I knew that I have to work through a lot of mental blocks about whether I can do that. I knew that I'd see some benefits that I would not ordinarily see even in my normal running. So really, it was the goal of the marathon that I knew would produce things in me in my running that I'd not seen in a number of years.
People who run, especially during the summer, look stupid to those who are non-runners. What do you gain? What's the benefit? What happens in you when you run? What takes place? Why would you say this is a good reason to run?
Okay, great question. Lots of things happen. Number one, there is some basic weight control, and as just about all of us know, the older we get, the harder it is to keep those encumbrances off. There is a mental release. They do studies on this, that there's a lessening of stress as you physically work out some of your stress and anxiety. And there, believe it or not, there's even the releasing in the body of something they call endorphins. This is a natural high. And if you run for a period of time, although my wife used to say when she used to be able to run, I'm waiting for this endorphin high to kick in, it never did. For a lot of us, as you run for a period of time, there's a natural release and there's just a feeling of well-being. So you feel more fit physically, mentally, and there's a bit of an emotional lift.
But 26,700 miles, or whatever a marathon is, there's a lot of reasons to negotiate yourself out of running. I mean, you can negotiate yourself out of the morning to get up and go train. You can negotiate out of a long run that day. You can negotiate yourself out of running up the hill. Why not just walk up the hill and kind of jog down it? I mean, you can negotiate. How do you fight the internal battles of wanting to quit? I mean, how do you keep from doing that?
Well, the easiest way to answer that is if you've ever run a marathon not trained, then you'll never do that again.
Okay.
And there's a difference between training for a marathon and even just regular running. And one of the key differences would be you have to have a long training run on a regular basis, meaning that if I'm running maybe 5 or 6 miles a day, I need to, on a Saturday, work to maybe 12 and then up to 14 and eventually up to around 20, 22. And it is those mental battles you fight in the middle of a 2.5, 3 hour run. But I'm thinking about what will happen if I don't have that training run, that I will not be prepared, that I won't be ready, and I'll be very, very miserable on that marathon and hit the wall and run out of energy and all of that.
Okay, so you've got a picture of the goal at the end, obviously, what you're trying to accomplish. But isn't there a sense, in, even in the middle of it, though, that your knees are shouting at you, your back shouting at you, your legs? I mean, how do you quiet them down? Yeah. What do you tell them? Is there a mantra you say?
Yeah. Well, sometimes I'll say something like, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength, even though my running is not his primary concern. But I think I envision the greater good, meaning okay. that even though my wind is screaming out, my legs are hurting, I know that there will be a benefit that supersedes the suffering I'm going through at that moment.
All right. So the price paid for running, from your perspective, is it worth it?
Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, I've run consistently now for about 27 and a half years. I haven't done marathoning that long. But, you know, the your heart rate, your overall health, your feeling of well-being, it's worth it. It's worth the price.
By appearances, can you tell the difference between a runner and a non-runner? He is 63. I don't know if you knew that or
That's
not.
That's just my hairline is 63.
Thank you, sir. The Hebrews 12 passage points out that if you live the Christian life, there will be suffering. It will be the agony of the race. There will be the long hills. The Christian life will have much like a marathon. You picture a marathon, and we're so used to them being celebrity events in some ways. You see big crowds, but truth is there are a lot of lonely runs early on Saturday morning or late on Thursday night or something. And there's nobody clapping, nobody cheering. You just run in 12, 14, 16 miles. Hebrews points out this could be hard. But Hebrews also points out it'll be worth it. The point is, in the middle of this, if the world treated Christ that way and we follow Christ down the same road he went and we pass through the same crowd in the same world, how do you expect a different result? There is going to be a difficulty. There is going to be a hard time. The Christian life wasn't designed for the greenhouse. The Christian life was designed for the harsh realities of life. It was Jesus who said, in this world you will have troubles. But be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. That second part is extremely important to hang on to, but don't miss the first part. Troubles are normal. Scripture says, surely as sparks fly upward, a man was born for troubles. Troubles are part of the Christian life. John, the apostle, writes, I'm a fellow sufferer with you, he said in the tribulation. And he's just describing life for the Christian. I'm a fellow sufferer with you in the tribulation. This week, I don't know what you had. I'm pretty confident, though, that you didn't come in here unscathed. Some of you are in the middle of a long run. Some of you are pretty tired. I don't know whether you got a pink slip this week and you bawled on the way home. I don't know whether one of you started the process of checking in with a wife or a parent with the Alzheimer's treatment. I don't know whether somebody this week found a mate unfaithful. I don't know whether somebody got word this week the baby isn't perfect. I don't know who went to a gravesite this week and wept, trying to imagine what life's going to be like. How do you live with this much change? I don't know this week who had a child divorce you. I don't know whose wife wept this week because there wasn't enough money to pay the bills. Suffering. It's multifaceted, and there's no way in a brief sermon like this that we can do much more than brush across it. There's so much the Scripture has to say. But in this text, there are two things that have to be said about suffering, two things that are primary. The one thing that he says in Hebrews 12 is whatever suffering you have to go through, whether you're even one of those who's tortured and one of those who face the jeers and flogging he's been talking about just in the previous two paragraphs, he says, whatever you go through is worth enduring for what will come after you have faithfully run your race. He uses Jesus as the illustration in verses 2 and 3. He says, "Let her fix her eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so you won't grow weary and lose heart." If you just logically follow him through, he's going, do you know where Jesus is now? And the answer is, yeah, he's sitting down at the right hand of the throne of God. Do you know what kind of amazing joy there is knowing he purchased your redemption? Do you know what amazing joy there is being returned back to the Father? Do you know what amazing joy there is in all of that? If you want to know how Christ endured the cross, the answer is he set his eye on the joy that was set before him. There is a finish line you need to see. Christ did that. Part of what his implication is do you want to sit down with Jesus? Do you want to sit down with Jesus? Do you want to taste the same joy? Then do not let the hardships of today keep you from running faithfully this agony, this race is before you. Look at that. I don't have tons of running illustrations. I'm running now. I haven't been running for the last quite a while, but I've been running the last month. And the only thing I can really remember in particular, one of my bright, shining moments in running, there weren't tons of them, I assure you, but it was in the state. Well, I guess it was districts before we went to state. And I ran the mile. And it was the worst running conditions I've ever experienced myself. I remember the coach that day got us around, and he said, you'll never run in worse conditions. He said, this isn't really fair for a track meet. He said, this is not going to be a test of skill. Today's a test of will. He said, those that have the most courage and backbone today, they'll win. People with the most skill may not. It was absolutely unbearable wind that day. It was absolutely freezing cold. It was one of the most difficult things I've ever run in my life. And I remember running down one straightaway that literally took forever because you just fought the wind. You just could not beat through the wind. You just couldn't do it. There were 20 people in particular heat that I was in, and I won it. I won it. I wasn't fast, but I was stubborn. And I remember just as simple, it's been almost 35 years ago, I remember a coach standing there weeping and pulling me to his chest and going, that's the most courageous run I've ever seen in my entire life. And that's just a coach on a silly little old four-lap kind of thing. He describes in this passage, you run faithful because it is Christ who will meet you with things like, well done, good and faithful servant. And it will be Christ who pulls you to his chest with nail-pierced hands. It is Christ who will say, hey, I am so incredibly proud of you. There is no doubt, this text says, for the joy set before you. Some of you had great temptations this week to do all kinds of silly things. You had temptations to bitterness. You had temptations to resentment. You had temptations to shut down. You had temptations to lash out. You had temptations to just stop living the vibrant Christian life because life wasn't fair. And this passage says, of course it's not fair. It's called the agony. When sin got introduced to this world, it is the agony. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul writes a text that you know very, very well. It's a text in which he describes this. He said, I am already being poured out like a drink offering. The time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. There's the word agony. I have kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but to all of those who have longed for his appearing. You go through Paul's life, three times beaten with leather straps, twice beaten with rods. He's stoned and left for dead. He's shipwrecked three times. He has people in the churches continually accusing him of not having a heart for the churches and somehow trying to prey on them. He has the daily burden of the churches. There's the cold of the travel. There's the robbers on the road. And yet you find a man who is absolute, resolute, eyes set forward. This is what I'm about. Your life is not any different. Your life's not any different. Oh, granted, you haven't had those same kinds of abuses, but your life is not any different where your eyes set. One of the things he says in this text is the end is worth the faithful enduring. The second point that he makes in here is he says that suffering won't be wasted by God even now. That the suffering is transforming. And this is a very important point. We've got to understand this. Suffering will not be wasted by God now. It's transforming. If you are faithful, the very suffering itself will be a part of the process that will turn you into a rich, deep man or woman of God with an unshakable faith. The very testing itself is good for me. As much as my tongue hates to say it, I need suffering. Boy, we hate to say that, but it's the truth. We need suffering. Without suffering, I won't have a life worth living. In a sense, and I don't know if this will make, works for you or not, but the very same hill that keeps a non-runner from running, he looks at it and goes, boy, that'd be really hard. So it keeps the non-runner from running. That very same hill turns a man into a faithful runner. There's something about that hill that is transforming to a man. The very alarm that causes a non-runner to reach over and shut it off in the morning and say, it's 5:30, it's dark, and I don't want to go out, and I'm just going to pull the covers over my head. That same alarm turns a runner into a runner. There's something about not just the muscles in the leg, but something occurs on getting up and getting out and doing the right thing. And I will do it. And something occurs that is transforming. It's not just the event, it's the process. And to make sure that I understand what he's talking about in this transformation, he adds another insight. He says, suffering will be God's training ground. He uses the word discipline. This is very important. You may need to write this in the margin of your Bible when you figure out how you want to use your own words. He is not talking about suffering in the form of discipline like we're being punished for something. There were times my father disciplined me because I needed punished. That is not what he's talking about here. He will use that partly as the illustration, but the discipline he's talking about here is closer to the word training. It's the word having to do with a father who would look at a son and say, there's things my son's going to need in the future. There's things my son's going to become. I have a boy now. Nothing wrong with the boy I have, but I want a strong, solid man. And there's some things I'm going to do between the point he's a little boy and the time he's a strong, solid man. And I'm going to try to produce in him an end result. The word discipline in this text is not a punishment word. It is a word about the training process. And so here's what he says. I don't care what you're going through. He doesn't give an out to it. He doesn't put a single out to it. He doesn't say, now, if you have this kind of category of suffering, he just opens it up. If you have suffering, you need to understand it will be a part of God's process of turning you in from a small child in the faith to a giant in the faith, someone who the Lord would say, this person's being conformed into my image. Julie and I were talking about this week, and like many things, Julie's exactly right. I just need to say yes, dear, more often. She said, when we suffer, our first tendency is to try to look for who to blame. Our first thought, who's causing this? Where'd it come from? And while the scriptures do describe different sources by which troubles come, God's primary emphasis in scripture is not who to blame in suffering. God is pretty unapologetic about that. It almost seems like it's irrelevant who causes the suffering. Ultimately, God says, I'll kidnap it and use it. Wherever the suffering came from, I'll kidnap it and use it, and I'll use it in your training process. And he uses the illustration the same way a father wants to produce in his son the right kind of man. And he goes on. This text says suffering is intended to that. In chapter 12, verse 10, the second part, he says this. He said, I want you to know the suffering will cause you to begin to share in the holiness of God. There is no bypass to that, gang. You can't go lock yourself in a closet somewhere and you can study and pray yourself to where you become a man or woman of holiness. Holiness comes with nights where you weep. Holiness comes for days that you hang on to Scripture and say, this doesn't make sense to me, but I'm going to do this. And holiness comes out of the endurance, faithful endurance. I'm going to be a man or woman who's obedient to God in this. Oh, it doesn't make a bit of sense to me. God, why is this? He says, it will also, he moves further down, it will have a harvest of righteousness in their life. It's the hold on enchilada. You want to become a person of wholeness. It'll make a man or woman of peace. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, the finest people I've ever met on the face of the earth, bar none, are faithful Christian people who have faithfully endured suffering. They are the pick of the litter. I look around a room like this, and I don't mind telling you, those of you who have most the touch of God on your life are those of you who have sometimes had the hardest lives, but you lived it faithfully. What happens? You show me somebody who faithfully hung in there, the transforming process, they became, and there's a whole list of things, and the time has gone by. Compassionate. You want to find somebody compassionate, you find somebody who was faithful in their own suffering. Long nights. It has softened their face. It has softened their hands. It has softened their heart. If you want to meet somebody who is real, you want to meet somebody who has depth to their life, I'll be honest with you, and just to use a quick illustration, I have always loved Melanie Klein. But Melanie Klein has gone through a trial that is so difficult for years. But I'm going to tell you, there is something in Melanie's heart you cannot buy anywhere, get anywhere. You can't get it anywhere else. It comes by, Melanie Klein is one of my heroes. There's a softness. And it comes out of suffering. One of my greatest heroes is a man named K.S. out of Southeast Asia. And I know the re-education camps, and I know the refugee camp, and I know his coming to Christ, and I know what all happened in that. And when I sit down, I go, how in the world does the world not have more guys like this? And the answer is, it doesn't have enough people who suffer faithfully. And those who suffer faithfully explode into something beyond imagination. A guy named B.W. Wood put it this way, pain is an ugly guest who we fear and yet cannot lock out. And yet when he is gone, we sometimes find he was a friend who left behind a very rich treasure. Compassion would be that. Of course, not everyone who suffers turns out that way. There are some of us in this room who suffer, and quite frankly, we became petty and mean-spirited. We simply became more focused on our own hurt and on our own world and less about the race we were running and less about he who wanted. And it's very possible to be jealous and envious then of anybody else who doesn't seem to suffer like I suffer. It's very possible to become more self-centered. Or on the other hand, you can become the Fanny Crosbys of the world, the Johnny Erickson Tatas, the Pauls of Philippians 1. You want to find somebody who looks like Jesus, you'll find somebody who has suffered. And they've suffered faithfully. You want somebody with spiritual insights? Suffering produces it. Spiritual insights and wisdom. Suffering is the sieve that you take the whole of your life and you dump it in. And when suffering begins to shake it around, all the chaff begins to blow away. Things that are meaningless. And the only things that remain are things with real value. And so you find that those who've suffered have amazingly simple life. They are traveling light through life. There's only a few things that matter to them. And those things matter very, very much. Character. And people in heaven. You show me somebody who has suffered, and I'll show you somebody who is absolutely the core value of what a Christian ought to be. They become the very heart of the issue. We long for all the wrong things. We ask for a good life. We ask for health. We ask for prosperity. We ask for wealth. All the things that flies in the garbage pile think they have. The bigger the garbage pile, the happier the fly. We say we have a good life. God describes good as being conformed to the image of His Son. So how do you know who to feel sorry for? The answer is you feel sorry for the street urchin who has no one who's raising him up. You feel sorry for the belligerent son who goes through discipline but doesn't even know what, doesn't even register. Who you feel sorry for is who no one's investing in. In the Screwtape letters, it's a letter that it's a series of letters that are put together as if they were from Satan. In it, C.S. Lewis writes, "If a man's years prove prosperous ones, Satan's position's even stronger. You see, prosperity knits a man to the world. He feels that he's finding his place in it, when in reality, it's finding his place in him. His increasing reputation, his widening circle of acquaintances, his sense of importance, the growing pressure of absorbing and agreeable work builds him up into a sense of really being at home on earth, which is just what we want, with the difficult task of unraveling their souls from heaven." And then he moves into the next one and says, "Suffering will undo everything we've done." There's so many things. I've got more pages than I can do. Within the circle of this congregation, there are those of you that have suffered. And those that have suffered faithfully, you stand apart. Those of us that have just trudged through suffering and we weren't very faithful in it, we just muddled another thing in our life. Faithfulness is the issue. I really didn't bring Dave up this the first time because he's a runner, although I didn't mind borrowing that. Dave, would you mind coming? Dave's a sweet, sweet, dear, godly man, somebody who is special and unique. I'm going to tell his own story, but it's interesting. I mentioned to my daughter yesterday, I was using Dave as an illustration and was doing. And she said, "Is that Josh's dad?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Dad, I'm going to tell you, I have never seen a junior high boy who has impressed me more with more depth." She said, "There is something about that boy that is absolutely different." She said, "That junior high boy," she said, "I don't know what that family has gone through. I don't know what has happened in their life. But that boy is absolutely the most phenomenal junior high boy I have ever met." Dave's real issue is not running marathons. It's just the life. Would you take a couple, 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes, and I want you to just tell him what life in your race has looked like.
Well, this passage that Randy just went over today first became very real to me in seminary, and I'll just take a couple minutes. We were 25 years old, and we're told we got pregnant, excited about that, and we're told that our baby had anencephaly, failure of the brain and skull to develop. And I learned a lot in a short amount of time about words like Planned Parenthood that I had no idea what that meant. And long and short of it is they pushed us to get an abortion, which we, of course, said no to. But basically, we were told our baby would die, 100% chance. And so that was a pretty excruciating 6 months. And my first real experience as a 25-year-old, newly married, been a Christian 3 years, was suffering. And I can tell you, it did produce things in me that, as much as I didn't like it, and as much as we prayed for our baby to be healed on our terms, which is this side of heaven, not the other, she was not. But that 6-7 month period was a period of prayer like I had not had up to that point, of truly being stripped of my self-reliance and depending on God, of learning what it meant to live out my faith, of having God use our suffering and our unwillingness to get an abortion to have medical people ask questions about their own view of life. So I know God used that, and it was very difficult, but it had an ending in November of 1986, and then we moved on. But it was around that same time my wife was diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis, which is a neurological disorder. Can have all kinds of symptoms. In the early years, it was a little double vision, a little numbness in the left hand. By the mid-90s, it was hitting her legs, about the time we were helping to start a new church in New England. And by 2000 is when we bought our first walker. And then by 2002, she was in a wheelchair. And she just continues to decline very rapidly, losing the ability to use her hands and write and stir spaghetti noodles and all of that. And I have to say that has, up to MS, I would have said the incident with our baby, our firstborn, would have been the most difficult thing we've gone through. Certainly at this point, this is a marathon that is not done yet. It's getting harder because circumstantially it's getting harder because she's getting worse. And, in the midst of that, we talk in marathon about hitting the wall when you just run out of energy. And I want to tell you, that there have been times that I've hit the wall and I've had to go back to the basics. And again, as Randy said, that what suffering demands of you, I've had to realize that I can't do this on my own. We can't. We have to depend on God like we've never depended on. I mean, Jesus Christ is a living reality. His love has to be an experiential reality in which I delight, as I rejoice in him. I also have to keep the vision, and again, Randy alluded to that, of what God can do through this, that he is using it to conform us to his image if we allow him. I mean, it makes you bitter or it makes you better. Those are our choices. And I don't do it perfect. I'm still a very impatient person. I'm not a great listener, but I am growing in my servanthood. I can look back over the last 5 years and say, wow, God has really changed. And it's been a laboratory for our children as well. They've had to be a part of this. They've had to serve. And they've reacted many times like you might think most kids would react, with extra chores and things. But God has used it. It has been the toughest marathon, and still continues to be, that I've ever been a part of. So I guess what I would say to you in the midst of your suffering, because some of you have harder stories than what I've shared, is that it challenges our convictions. What do I really believe about God? Is he good? Is he wise? Is he powerful? And it takes me back to the cross. I know he's good because he died for me. The great commandment is love God, love people. The greatest truth is that God first loved us. That's real. You pray. I still pray to be delivered from it until God says, quit praying that prayer. I still pray for healing, but at the same time, I say, Lord, I don't want to waste this time. I want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant. I want to live the life, run the race that God has marked out for me, even though this isn't the race that we have that would have chosen. We would not have chosen this kind of race. I would challenge you and encourage you to really see God and what it means to rejoice in him, not our circumstances. I've had to be taken back to those basic things that Paul says, rejoice in the Lord always, pray without ceasing, and everything give thanks. And then I would simply say, grow through this knowing that, number one, we learn to depend on God. Number two, he causes us to share in his holiness. So let me say, as I wrap up, number three, this is part of our witness. The world suffers. But how we suffer as believers, do we deny our faith? Do we deny our spouse? I know the statistics in my situation. Over 90% of the men who are married to women with multiple sclerosis divorce their wives. 90%. So if I simply hang on to my marriage vows and honor those vows, God can use that. As I love my wife, as Christ loved the church. So as Randy said, there's so much you can say on this. You know, I'm in a good place right now. I've had a good prayer retreat with God recently. Sometimes I'm like the Jacob that doesn't seem to prevail with God. I want to wrestle, I want to win, and I don't. And like Job, we just have to trust God that he knows what he's doing, and we have the cross to show us that ultimately he loves us no matter what we may go through.
I said to you that Hebrews 10, 23 and 24 are the two key verses in the book of Hebrews. One has to do with, let us hold unwaveringly the hope we profess, and the second is encourage one another. Because you share the journey with people who need the encouragement. You running faithful is a portion of it, but your simple running with them in times of difficulty. Gang, I wouldn't share this body of Christ with any other set of believers. Thanks. You've made the run to be a pleasure for me. In the middle of difficult times, you've made it to be pleasure. May we take good care of one another. The Church of Jesus Christ. As he comes, and I know we're running a little long, let me tell you one last thing. It happened last Sunday morning. The lady had no idea I was preaching on next week, but she stopped me, and she heard last week's Sunday, and she made this comment. She said this morning, last Sunday morning, she said, I wept doing my devotions. She said, I wept for joy. She said, we raised our kids, and she said, I had a husband at times I thought was a little more firm than he ought to be. He said, he was never mean. Don't misunderstand me. He said, he was always a little more firm with the kids than I thought he should have been. She said, because my natural instinct was, let's comfort them now. Let's comfort them now. Let's make it easy for them now. Come on, there's no reason. Let's comfort them now. And said, he was always had a vision out there of what my kids could become. And she said, I realized this morning, I looked at my 18-year-old daughter, and the girl I have has an unshakable faith. And she has maturity and depth and love and kindness. And she said, I went in and woke my husband up this morning, and I said to my husband, thank you. The vision you had for what they could become was better than my vision of let's comfort them now. She said, fathers do that, don't they? The Heavenly Father's doing that in your life perhaps today. Would you trust him?